Live from Burbank, California, land of cow farms and brutal country justice, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's a corn-swoggling varmint, Mark Maron.
All right. Thank you. How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, of course, need machines, all you folks out there, happy birthday. That was just a general one. You got to figure someone listening, it's his birthday or her birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Hey, remember Hobo?
Congratulations, you made it.
Remember Hobo Kelly?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, she take out her big magnifying glass and sing, put another... No, that was Sheriff John.
What the hell are you talking about? How did we start? Like, we're literally 40 seconds in, and I'm lost.
You know, you can't start over.
I know. What are you talking about, Jim?
If life has taught you anything, you cannot start over.
Don't talk to me about it. I talked to my old man today, Mr. Happy, Joey Chuckles.
Yeah, how's that going?
Oh, man, I talked to old man Maron today, and I'm telling him, like, you know, it's pretty rough sometimes, you know, running a business. Having a show on the air, you know, you learn these things, you learn new things about yourself. Then he goes, yeah, isn't it amazing when you finally get all this wisdom, you just croak. That's what he says. This existential equation in his head, and I wonder why I got problems. I am programmed to be nihilistic and depressed as the Trump card. You just Trump somebody. Like say something like you did today that you're happy about.
Well, you know, I put up a painting today.
What the hell's the point? You're gonna die anyways. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I get to see the painting while I'm dying.
Man, I know, but what difference does it really make?
Well, I'll have something pretty to look at.
Yeah, whatever. What else did you do?
Well, I had a nice meal and pet my cat.
It doesn't really matter, though, because you're going to die. You know what I mean? It's just so transient, these pleasures. See? It's awkward. That's what I grew up with.
I fed a squirrel.
Oh, that's good for the squirrel, but, you know, it's going to die. Eventually, the squirrel's just going to die. He's going to take what you gave him, put him in a tree, forget about it, and die with the stuff you gave him in the tree. Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. There's no winning. You understand what I'm saying? This is what I grew up with. And then he'll say, like, I saw this movie. You know, like, he'll be excited about his thing, but anything you say about your thing, you know, he's not that excited about.
You sound kind of self-centered.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, now we're stopping the conversation because I'm starting to choke up a little bit. All right,
really?
I thought I had it resolved, but it's not resolved. No, I'm sending him that new Bruce Springsteen CD. I've become able to deal with my father today on the show. Sometimes very draining. Today on the show from the Daily Show, Lewis Black. He was going to call us actually from the set of the Daily Show, the place where you used to work. So try to keep cool. All right.
Yeah,
I'll
choke back the tears.
All right. Nancy Northrup, president of the Center for Reproductive Rights, will talk to us about the future of abortion legislation and reproductive freedom on a state to state basis. What's happening with Roe v. Wade? Tom Reynolds, the author of I Hate Myself and Want to Die, the 52 most depressing songs you've ever heard, will be here to relish in the depression, to have some fun with those songs. I've reached out to the blogosphere, our people, email and otherwise, to give us some names of some songs they thought might make the list. Jack Boulware will be here. Boulware, whose band Resin, which is a band of old farts who don't really play regularly, get together. They do special gigs. Resin played a Zappa tribute gig up in San Francisco, so Jack can tell us about that. Were you ever a Zappa fan? You seem like you... No, actually, no, you're not.
No, but he grew up in my hometown, Claremont. I think he was around there.
You know, he's
Zappa and Todd Rundgren, one of Todd Rundgren's... no, not Todd Rundgren. I'm talking about Jackson Brown.
Maybe it was Hobo Kelly you're thinking of. Was it Hobo Kelly in the magnifying glass?
He was based around in L.A. too, Hobo Kelly.
In the magnifying
don't
glass?
Don't make fun of Hobo Kelly.
How can you not make fun of someone?
She looked out in her magic magnifying glass and saw all the children and told them to go underneath their bed and find a present.
Wow. Hey, is this for real?
Yes, Hobo
all right,
Kelly.
Because I don't know with you anymore. I don't know. I also wanted to say this, if you can. I got this up on the website. If you can, go to truthout.org. They need some money. Send them some money. They need donations. They're a nonprofit. They do a great service. They go through the world of news, and they filter it, and they send it to you. You get on their mailing list. There's a lot of commentary there that you might not see anywhere else. Like we were just talking about before, Jason Leopold's commentary on the impending Roe indictment that was supposed to happen today after a meeting that went on for 15 hours on Friday that Roe claims didn't happen.
On the fourth floor of Roe's law partners or what, you know,
Don't take anything he. Why take anything he says for truth? I mean, you know, Rove actually said the other day in reframing a debate, not even a debate, reframing the poll issue. This is a guy that dismisses polls, and he goes on to say that the president's personal approval rating is great, right? He says that, but you know what? The bottom line is the fact is that it isn't. In an examination of recent polling shows that his favorability ratings have been slipping. They're in the 30s and 40s this year. The last time they ever were in their 60s, which is what Britt Hume was saying in response to Karl Rove, mm-hmm. Was it Britt Hume? No, it was Jim Angle. Yeah, the White House correspondent on that show on Fox News said it was around 60%. And the last time it was at 60% was in February 2005. See, what these guys do is that if it was ever true, they'll draw from it on the premise that no one will call them on it. It's ridiculous.
You know what? It's worked.
Yeah, of course it works, because no one's going to do the research. We got short order news. We should do it. We got Lewis Black coming up. We're going to talk about immigration with Mark Cooper a little bit. But right now, we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. Here's the Mark Maron Show short order news. At a recent appearance, Karl Rove said most Americans liked President Bush and blamed his poor poll ratings on the Iraq War. Rove also had more positive things to say about the president, but uncontrollable laughter drowned out the rest of his comments. The Bush administration announced the United States will restore full diplomatic relations with Libya 25 years after they were cut. Muammar Gaddafi is comfortable with his new status as a good guy, saying, sure, being the new Hitler was fun for a while, but what's the point when they're just going to hand the title to every Hussein, Jong-il, Noriega, Putin, Milosevic, Ortega, Ahmadinejad, Chavez, other Hussein, and warlord to be named at a later date? That comes down the pike. Wow, that's about two beats too long, that one. Researchers at the University of Nevada, Reno, have concluded there is a direct correlation between secondhand smoke in Las Vegas casinos and damage to employees' DNA. Said one Vegas researcher, what happens to your DNA stays in your DNA. That's a short order news for tomorrow. Thank you. Charlie, I thought you were coming in tomorrow. Charlie just walked in. Works for the show. Gets us our guests, and he's expecting a check that I don't have. That was tomorrow. That was going to be tomorrow. All right. I can't see what he's saying, but we got Lewis Black. Is he on the phone? He hasn't called yet, so we'll see, right? Could have Lewis Black any minute.
I can do an impression of it. So. Now he worships the sun with his huge stones. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
That was an honoring bit of throwing to me. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Look, folks, I knew Lewis Black back in the days when he ran a weekly show on the west side of New York. I think the place was called the West End. I'm not even sure. Now he's one of the biggest names in the comedy game. He's a regular commentator on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he's touring constantly, appearing this weekend in some sort of mini theater tour of Ohio. You can go to his website for dates. How are you, Lewis?
I'm good. How you doing?
Yeah, you got a big few days in Ohio there.
Oh, 5 days.
5 days in Ohio.
The fun never stops.
I swear to God. What was the name of that place on the west side? The West End.
West Bank Cafe.
West Bank Cafe.
Yeah.
God, times have changed, man.
Oh, yeah. No,
you thought it was over, and look what's happened.
Except it was good there because I always had free liquor, so I was actually doing as well then as I'm doing now.
Oh, come on. you are treated like an astronaut on the road, aren't you?
No.
Oh, come on. You walk into diners, they're like, oh, my God, Mr. Black is here. What do you want?
Yeah, get him some mozzarella sticks.
So what's going on? What do you think of that speech last night? Anything? You got anything on the immigration thing?
It was tremendous.
Terrific.
You know, it's really another problem solved. I am so glad we're getting it done this quickly.
Yeah.
You're out in California, but here, you know, it has no effect in New York City.
Right.
Here we don't. Here we're like all immigrants.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's just one big mess of people there from all different kinds of countries.
Yeah, nobody's making enough money to get by. So, but they, I mean, it's just, the thing I love was the idea of building the wall.
Right.
A 700-mile wall. We can't build a levee in New Orleans, but we can get a wall built.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Also, they're going to use drone planes. They're going to increase border security. It's like they have not been able to stop a pound of pot coming over the border for 40 years. It's amazing to me. All this stuff is corrupt and dirty anyways. I mean, in the sense that what needs to come through will be allowed to come through.
Yeah, exactly. But my favorite was I was on a morning radio somewhere in Ohio today, and one of the DJs had a very good line. He said, "You know, what should be done is that we'll let them in and give them citizenship if each person has to bring 20 gallons of oil unleaded."
Yeah, just to put in the. It's weird. Isn't it weird when you do radio in terms of like morning radio, you don't know what you're walking into, and you just never know, what the ideology of the guy talking is. Like, hey, we're here with Louis Black, so the Jews should die, right, Louis?
Yeah, I know.
Am I right with the Jewish problem?
But it's always amazing when they're funny.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of talented radio people. Some people aren't as lucky as Mr. Louis Black. I'm not talking from personal experience, so. Hey, put John Stewart on. Where's that monkey? Come on.
That monkey's getting ready to work. And Dennis Leary's on tonight.
Oh, yeah? You guys are backstage hanging out?
We were hanging out, actually.
Yeah, Dennis is a nice guy. Would you have a smoke-off?
We did. Yeah, it was in I-1.
You beat Leary at a smoke-off?
My favorite was I was working with Dennis backstage, yeah. And at Carnegie Hall, there was a thing for the Caroline's Comedy Club at a 25th anniversary. And we're all standing around, and Dennis lights up and backstage at comedy at Carnegie Hall.
Yes,
and everybody stopped and said, "You can't do that." He said, "Well, you know what? You know what? I'm the first one to go on. Why don't you tell me? Why don't I just leave that?"
I'll see you later. Was that
just like, wow? I couldn't even do that.
Was that the sound of the Daily Show starting? I heard
that's
in the background.
Yeah, but it started, but then it didn't start. Now they John just goes out and talks to him for a while.
Oh, and makes him feel like that he likes him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that.
You know the deal.
Yeah, a lot of hosts do that. Hey, we're gonna have a good time, and then they walk backstage. I hate those people. Those people are horrible. I once taught Conan O'Brien my mantra because right when he was starting out, he was very nervous, and I said, right before you go on, you just repeat this to yourself over and over again. Hide the hate. Hide the hate. Hide the hate. And I think he used it for a few years. So what? So what's on your mind, man? What have you been? What's going on in your head lately?
Well, I just did this HBO special, so I was dealing with. I can't. You know what really was the thing with dealing with the HBO special? I can't. The thing that's fascinating. I can't keep up with everything. I can't even keep up with them.
Yeah, with who? With
all this administration, the Democrats. I can't keep up with every. I open the paper up. I go, I could write about this, and this, and then I pass out. It's too much stuff.
That's absolutely true, and it's hard for a guy like you because you got to do commentary on a fairly regular basis on television. Then you got to go on the road, every damn night of your life because
exactly.
And they're gonna like expect you to like address today's news, and you're like, hey, I got an act here. what am I gonna throw out stuff that's half baked?
I know, and I just want to go on stage now with a newspaper and hold it up and go, read it, I'll see you.
Yeah, just be like Mort Sahl, but never address the paper.
But you can't even deal with, you can't top what they're doing. We're not even allowed,
Yeah, I'll give you, you got to give yourself a 2-month window. As long as you're not doing what Robert Klein does and going, Quayle's an idiot.
No, I've been doing. I mean, the thing is I finally, I did. I've been doing Cheney's shooting the guy in the face because that was because I thought it worked as the metaphor for us going to Iraq rather than Iran.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he's supposed to shoot the Quayle, and he shoots his friend.
Right.
He should have gone into they're supposed to shoot Iran. He shoots Iraq. It's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet you it works good when you have a lot of momentum behind it and you're on stage. Come on, buddy. So you happy to be in New York for a few days? Where the hell do you live anymore?
I live in the city, but I haven't been around much. I basically do the traveling, and I did some movies, so that was fun.
Yeah, like what movie?
The most fun was Barry Levinson did a film. I've known him since forever, and he did a movie about. Robin Williams runs. He's a comic who has a show like Bill Maher's or Jon Stewart's, and runs to be president.
Okay, a comic is running to be president,
yep.
And it's Robin.
And I'm the head writer.
And you're the head writer, his speech writer.
I'm initially his head writer, and then I make the transition to be a speech writer. And Christopher Walken is his business manager.
You know, Robin's used a lot of comics to write for him without telling them.
Exactly. But he was good in this. I should be good, I think. Who the hell knows?
No, I think he's good. He's a good actor. I think he's a pretty decent guy, too, I believe.
But he is a pretty decent guy, and he's very smart. He's way, way smart. It's scary smart.
Yeah.
Smarter than us.
Really?
Well,
wow.
He reads books, and he remembers everything.
I know he remembers everything. I've seen him improv the same thing over and over again. It's unbelievable. I'm sorry, I'm player-hating. So,
it's all right.
What was the other movie you did?
I did Accepted, which comes out August 11th, and that's with, it's a group of kids who set up a fake college, and I'm the fake dean.
Oh, that sounds pretty funny.
And it is funny. I get to walk around in a bathrobe and underwear for most of the film, so it's good.
Oh, yeah?
A complete reprobate.
Do you want to try and do your piece from the show tonight on my show right now?
They want me to do a Godfather sequence, and I can't do it.
What do you mean?
You know, in other words, you're my brother and I love you, but don't ever take sides against Focus on the Family again.
Yeah.
I do it terrible.
Yeah,
it's awful.
Yeah, but you're Lewis Black, and it doesn't really matter as long as you get the ideas.
It's vaguely. I'll stumble toward it. I used to be able to do Chinese people better than this.
Yeah. Back in the Jerry Lewis days, back when it was okay.
That's when it was all right to do Orientals.
Here's a little, this Oriental person. Yeah. I was just in Vegas, and the entire old guard was there. Like, Slayton was there.
Oh, wow.
He's not old, but, I mean, there was a guy's a little from the generation before. Well, Seinfeld, Jay Leno, Slayton, George Wallace, Don what? Rickles were there.
Man.
Not in the same, all in different places. And I was at the lounge at the Palms.
Were you really? How was that?
It's good, man. It's probably too small a room for you, but they got a theater there that you should do. It's a good hotel. They draw young people.
So you're having fun out there.
Kinda. I don't like Vegas. It's very draining, and it takes. It's hard for me to pretend like I'm having a good time losing money.
I know it is.
Do you gamble?
Yeah, I do.
A lot?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
I was cured of that early.
Oh yeah. Well, oh yeah. Because it hurts. It hurts. There's nothing more empty.
Well, it's the fear of God. You just go. You know, I used to have I'd have $300, and that's what I could play with. And one night, I went. You know, I was going through everything. I was with John Heyman of all people.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I was at Caesars with him, and we just got drunker and drunker, and I lost $500 and then won it back. And when I finally won it back, that was, and then I went, that's it. That fear is worked in my, I can't really gamble much anymore.
All right. Well, I'm easing into that, but I lost some money. I'm not going to go into it. Thanks for hanging out, Lewis. Have a good
I really appreciate it. We'll do it again sometime.
Have a good show. Anytime.
Okay, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Bye, buddy.
Bye-bye.
All right, Lewis Black heading on to the stage of The Daily Show. We'll be back with Nancy Northrup and Mark Cooper. Stay with us.
And now back to the guy who voted for Taylor Hicks. Mark Maron.
Don't even know what that means. Don't even know. But look up resentment again. Keep that on your screen. The Center for Reproductive Rights is working to guarantee access to contraception, reproductive education, and safe and legal abortion on a worldwide level. Here in the U.S., the future of Roe v. Wade is grim. That means that the future of reproductive education and safe legal abortion is in jeopardy as state legislatures take those rights away and put women's lives in jeopardy and retard adolescents seeking advice with no information or bad information. Here to give us an update on the national fight for reproductive rights is the president of the Center for Reproductive Rights, Nancy Northrup. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
I'm glad you're here. How close are we to Roe v. Wade being overturned, really?
Well, the answer to that question is going to be found both in the new justices who are on the Supreme Court and whether or not, as they testified in their Senate confirmation hearings, they do respect precedent. That's going to be important to find out. And it's going to depend on what happens with the rest of President Bush's term and whether we have one more opening on the Supreme Court.
Now, I've heard a lot of Democrats talking about trying to take the issue off the table as a divisive issue and let it be dealt with on a state level. Do you see that happening in the Democratic platform?
Whether that happens on the Democratic platform, I've got to say it's a lousy idea.
Right.
This notion that somehow, you know, if we reverse Roe versus Wade and send it back to the states, it's all going to work out fine and we can go on and not have abortion be such a divisive issue in the United States. The reality is it's a divisive issue because there are very different ideological perspectives.
Right.
About people's right to make decisions about their reproductive health, about when and whether to have children, about women's role in society, all those things. It's
yep.
a big ideological difference. And if you send it back to the states, what would happen would be a 30-year war. Every state election, every judicial election at the state level, every city council race, every race in the country is going to be permeated by the abortion battle. So those who think somehow if we just reverse Roe, send it back to the states, it'll all work out, it won't.
Right. It'll become a regional battle, and there won't be a race that is run that won't have it involved in the campaign. Whereas if they were just to include it in part of their platform as part of defending individual rights in this country and the right to safe and legal health care in the reproductive way, that would be actually standing for something progressive and reasonable.
That's right. And the reason that we need to have the court's protection is so that it does not become something that, you know, women in Louisiana can't make these decisions, but women in California and New York can. And what's really interesting is while the United States is backsliding on reproductive freedom, we're seeing advances elsewhere in the world. I mean, just last week in Colombia, in Latin America, their constitutional court ruled that there were exceptions that had to be part of Colombia's ban on abortion, that in cases where women's health and life is at risk, cases of rape, cases of carrying a tragically deformed fetus, all those cases necessitate on human rights grounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the rest of the world is getting it, and we're not.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this state-to-state battle, because this, I think there are women's lives in danger as we speak. Now, four states have passed trigger bans if Roe were to be reversed. Can you explain what those are?
Yeah, those are laws that say that should Roe versus Wade be overturned, and some of them say it'll be the policy of the state to recriminalize abortion, and some of them flat out say that, you know, put actual restrictions on abortion or bans on abortion into place. What most people don't realize is that they think, you know, if Roe versus Wade is reversed, we're going to go back and have this debate at the state level, state by state, legislature by legislature. But in fact, the building blocks are already in place to recriminalize abortion. So you have states that have bans that have never been enjoined, that instantly would go into effect if Roe was reversed. You have other states that have passed bans, including some that passed bans after Roe. We know that, of course, South Dakota did that this year, Louisiana did it in the early 90s, Utah did it in the early 90s. Those injunctions against those laws could be lifted, you know, the next day. And again,
right,
abortion criminalized in those states. Well, so there is a tremendous amount of legal building blocks that have been put in place over the years by the anti-choice movement that would be ready to go into action the moment Roe was reversed.
Well, it's a horrifying reality in this country, the persistence of religious fanatics and their ability to restrict human rights because of their diligence and their patience is a little bit disturbing. I can just hope that there are as many people as you and your group that are trying to work on that grassroots level to fight this.
Right. Well, I think it's so, I mean, I think people need to understand your point that it is fundamentally a battle of religious perspectives.
Right.
And in saying that, I'm a Sunday school teacher,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I drag my kids kicking and screaming with me on Sunday to
yeah.
church, but that's in my private life, and that's in my, you know, role as a parent. But when you get to the role of the government and society, it is a diversity of views, and religions have a diversity of views on the question of abortion and contraception. And the court has always recognized that and says, you know what, the Constitution has to apply to people of diverse religious beliefs.
Yes.
And I think that people need to, the pro-choice public really needs to wake up and understand that the issue isn't going to go away, because for our opponents, they will not tolerate a diversity of views on the issue of abortion. And, you know, pro-choice people will let people decide in their individual lives. And that's a very different fundamental ideological divide.
And I think also it's important, Nancy Northrup, President at Center for Reproductive Rights, to realize that the 22 states that are considering stricter parameters to restrict access to abortion and to reproductive education, that is the home of 50% of the population of this country. And they accounted for about 37% of the abortions performed in the year 2000. And if they shut this stuff down, there is absolutely no way that hundreds of women are going to be compromising their health and possibly put their lives in jeopardy for unsafe medical practices. It's going to happen. You can't train people not to need this stuff. This is the way it's been since the beginning of time.
Well, that's right. And again, to look, you know, all we have to do is look around the world and see that even where abortion is criminal in all circumstances, which was in the case of Colombia before their constitutional court ruled, you have still an incredibly high rate of abortions, because women who feel that is the choice they have to make at that time, make it, whether it's legal or illegal, whether it's safe or unsafe. And so, you know, we only have to look outside our borders to realize that, you know, to recriminalize abortion in the United States would be bringing back a tremendous burden on women's health and their lives.
Yeah, and already there are some women in some states that are traveling hundreds and hundreds of miles, if they have the ability to do that, to get safe medical attention. Now, what are the most important fights right now, and how can my listeners help in the last minute we have here?
Well, I would say there's important fights going on in all states, and obviously there's an important fight going on in Washington. And I would say two things. One, get involved at your local level, get involved at your state level. And two, pay attention to what the Senate is doing about the next Supreme Court nominations. And pay attention to this case we're going to have in the Supreme Court this fall, which is all about, is this new court going to follow precedent?
Thank you so much, Nancy Northrup. Great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
You
Bye-bye.
Take care. That was Nancy Northrup, president of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Do get involved in this, because this is the difference between moving towards theocracy and moving towards a secular country that respects human rights and individual freedom. We'll be back with Mark Cooper to talk about immigration after this.
Now, please remain seated. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Let's get into this speech last night, this bunch of bunk. President Bush trying to have it both ways and maybe not having it any way at all, though it seems like some of the premises were good. But this deploying 6,000 National Guard troops, given the state of the Guard and how overextended they are, and just the fact that it is a political theater, is disturbing. And one of the great commentators on immigration is Mark Cooper from markcooper.com, from The Nation, from the LA Weekly. You can go to markcooper.com for everything Mark Cooper. Right now he's with us. So, Mark.
Yes.
Let's go point for point. Now, this securing the border, saying this deploying of 6,000 National Guards who are going to be unarmed and just sit down there, is political theater, is it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, these troops, basically, President Bush called out the National Guard to put down a rebellion within his own party.
Right, yeah. Good
point. I mean, the task of those National Guardsmen and women is to satisfy the demand from the right wing of his party and from the House leadership to engage only in law enforcement, enhanced enforcement on the border, hoping that, or arguing, that that's going to make the problem of illegal immigration go away.
But isn't it, it's obnoxious in the sense that he's exploiting and using the military in this way to really make, to gain some political ground with the extreme right wing of his party. These are troops that aren't really going to do anything. There are troops that could be, you know, put in place other places in preparation for, say, hurricane season. You know, it just seems to me that this is a great example of the length that this administration will go to try to maintain their base.
Yes.
All right. So now
you're right.
So,
but there is one hidden possible silver lining in this.
Uh-huh.
You know, the president said that he was thinking of rotating these troops out every 2 or 3 weeks. You know, if you rotate 6,000 troops out every 2 weeks over the 24-month period that the president's talking about, you're looking at 300,000 troops. So, you know, I don't want to go way out on a limb, but maybe this is a way for the president to save face and pull the troops out of Iraq, because he's going to have to use approximately 150,000 troops per year to do all the bookkeeping and van driving and road building that is going to be the real task of this National Guard.
Because, well, okay. All right, but you know, we'd all like the troops out of Iraq, but it seems that to create a crisis, an emergency situation.
But here's the problem for the president. The problem for the president is that this strategy of the border, of bringing the guard to the border, just like his strategy in Iraq, it's already failed because the insurgency, if you will, in this case his own House Republicans, weren't satisfied. I mean, we can already put this in the past tense, less than 24 hours later. It didn't work because the most recalcitrant part of the Republican Party the Sensenbrenners and the Tom Tancredos who are running this vaguely xenophobic House position on immigration, they didn't buy it. They don't want 6,000 invisible National Guardsmen. They want a couple of 100,000 M16, toting, tank-driving U.S. military troops on the border.
In turrets on a wall.
Exactly.
Now, okay, well, let me ask you a question then. Now, it seems to me that, given that there's that faction within the Republican Party mm-hmm. that want that. Now, it seems to me that I heard the leader of the Minutemen, mm-hmm. who I have a problem with, but Ed Schultz puts him on his show all the time, or a couple of times, and he was actually saying that the National Guard thing was bunk, and he was also framing the border situation as a national security issue in terms of terrorism. Now, it seems there is a faction within this ultra-right wing, and within, I guess this sounds very Rovian to me, Mark Cooper, where they're trying to make this into a terrorist-based threat.
Well, here's what I say, Mark. If we think that Karl Rove is responsible for the president being at 29%, in his sixth year, then yeah, maybe it's Rovian. This is also Rovian, because as much as they're trying to pump this up by using the threat of terror and securing the border, et cetera, it's already failed.
Okay.
And what we're going to see in the days to come is a very uncomfortable situation for the president, for his own party, because they really are split. Just to keep this in a level-headed electoral context.
Yeah.
Just remember that all the House members are running for re-election this year. Not all of the Senate is, and there's a lot of Republican House members who are feeling very endangered by what they see as a tidal wave of protest against them at the ballot boxes. And they think they need, in the short term, this sort of fear campaign about terror and the border and blah 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 that President Bush responded to last night. But there are other Republicans who are taking a longer term view and are worried because they know they need the Latino vote.
Right.
And they know that what happened last night is very dangerous in terms of attracting that Latino vote. So you've got a Republican Party that's really split right up the middle on this.
Well, that was what I was trying to figure, was that were someone doing the math that, pit the sort of jingoistic, defensive, angry, low-income American numbers of those voters against the 11 million illegal immigrants, about 9 of which can probably vote, and their extended families and their cause.
Exactly.
It just seems that the numbers are certainly with that Latino vote. Now, it seems to me, also last night, Mark Cooper, that he was trying to have it both ways, and that he was basically talking about what McCain and Kennedy were talking about.
He was, and that's what made it so tragic in a way, because actually, the problem for, look, here's the real problem, Mark. The real problem is that George Bush delivered the speech, right?
Right.
So his credibility is so low, he could have gotten up and said the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and you'd have a 50-50 poll on that. Right,
right.
So that's his biggest problem, is just how much credibility he doesn't have. That said, if you take that speech in the abstract and you reorder the paragraphs and you move the emphasis around a little bit, what the president said last night was not unreasonable, and in fact it completely overlaps with comprehensive immigration reform, which is supported by a lot of liberals, including Ted Kennedy and the unions, etc. So it wasn't but that's what made it so pathetic for the president, because he couldn't even satisfy, as much as he genuflected to that right-wing base, he still couldn't satisfy them, because the minute he started talking about legalization of illegal people who are here, and the minute he started talking about their need to be able to get some sort of citizenship, and a guest worker program and accommodating you know, a lot of these immigrants, that was it, man. His base just clicked that thing right off and said, oop, we've been sold out again by, you know, a blue-helmeted secret supporter of the black helicopters of the UN.
It's interesting. It's too bad that weird right-wing kind of delusional base has leaders at all, because he probably could have fooled them if there weren't people actually speaking for them in the House. Now,
you're right, but let me just say to you that if the president had been more forceful on it, don't forget, it's the president who put this on the national agenda, to his credit, by the way, 2 years ago in his 2004 State of the Union speech. If the president had not gone AWOL on this for the last 2 years and had been out there kind of explaining the nuances of this, you're right, he would have diffused his own House leadership. But he's, you know, just like Katrina, this guy reacts. He's been overtaken by offense. So once the immigration thing got completely out of his control, then he decides to come in with too little, too late.
Now, one thing no one's talking about is a reassessment of trade agreements with Mexico to address this problem at its economic roots. Now, no one is talking about that except for the extreme left wing. Now, why is that? Why is that completely impractical?
Well, that's because if you'll remember back, you know, unfortunately, we don't remember history very well in this country. So as bad as George Bush has been, and he's been pretty bad, you have to remember that it was the first political act that Bill Clinton did was to break his own party over the question of NAFTA. And that's exactly what he did. So there's a whole lot of Democrats, along with Republicans, who support those trade policies, and they've not put them into question. And they are a contributing factor. I wouldn't say they're the sole factor, but they're certainly a contributing factor to the immigration from Mexico. And if you're suggesting that our politicians are opportunists, and they're not going to fully address the issue, I think you're right.
So I guess ultimately what we're looking at here, Mark Cooper, in the future is that these 11 million or a large percentage of them are now going to be sort of effectively locked into this country to be in a guest worker program if they're not criminals. And people who have been on the road to legal immigration are going to be separate than them in their treatment. And there's going to be all kinds of concessions made and ID cards made, and they're going to be enabled to vote.
It's hard to predict because we're so close to the November election that the most likely prediction is that nothing is going to happen of any substance between now and November, that any real deal on immigration is going to fall apart or it's going to be kind of ineffective. So in the short run, we're going to have what we've got. In the longer run, I really do think we've made some progress, not because of the president. We've made progress just because of the sheer numbers, the way the economy works, and because of the mobilization of immigrants that we've seen in the last few months. So slowly but surely, I think as we go into the next political season, both parties are recognizing that they have to deal with this increasingly Latino part of the population and get somewhat real about it. So it's going to be back and forth. It's going to be a question of who has the momentum.
Yeah.
You know, reason for a sliver of optimism.
All right. Well, Mark Cooper, thanks for jumping on with us for a few minutes.
Thanks, Mark.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Mark Cooper, markcooper.com for all that information. It's interesting. The people that are feeling disenfranchised by this are the extreme left wing, the extreme right wing. Huh? There is no middle, but people keep playing to it. We'll be back with, who do we got? Tom Reynolds, Jack Boulware, some funny. Stay with us.
And now he's got a dog named Boo, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
You know, we checked into the blog here during the day, because our show is taped. I don't want to surprise anybody. And I reached out to them to get some information for our next guest. And now, I just see on here, on the blog, this is by Orbit Boy, who's on there all the time, says Jason Leopold versus Tim Grieve. Tim Grieve, a guest on our show yesterday. These two guys are having quite a knockdown dragout this week over Leopold's shoddy reporting on the Rove indictment. Salon.com's War Room has lots on it today. All I have to say is I'm not giving a dime to truth out if Leopold isn't proven right very, very soon, like by Friday. See, because I've been asking people to give some money to Truth Out, because I use Truth Out constantly. Truthout.org despite whatever their comment, despite Jason Leopold. Look, Larissa Alexandrovna over Raw Story, you know, these people use sources. I mean, sources are what they are. If they're good sources, they're good sources. Maybe Leopold was set up. Maybe it's not his fault. He's done some good reporting before. We'll see. This thing has been, they've been trying to make a fool out of this marginal press, you know, a lot by playing around with this Rove thing. That, as you were saying before the show, Jim, Leopold could have been set up, but it does not diminish Truthout's importance in terms of going through the news, selecting articles and commentary that is important to the progressive cause and important to truth in general. And I don't think that you can just say, you know, screw that. I mean, this is an organization, not unlike Media Matters, that is providing a pretty important service for us. So I wouldn't be so quick to say to hell with Truthout just because of Jason Leopold. You know, we've all been waiting for this Rove indictment for a long time. I mean, you can't just blame, you know, Jason Leopold all of a sudden like he's the idiot. Now, hold on. Right now, music, my friends, we're shifting gears. I'm excited about it, too, because this is funny stuff and it's a great book. Music has such a profound influence on everyone. It can change your mood. It can facilitate time travel. It can get you hot. But some music is depressing, not always in a bad way, but depressing nonetheless. Tom Reynolds has compiled some of those depressing songs and the reasons they are depressing in his new book, I Hate Myself and Want to Die, the 52 most depressing songs you've ever heard. Welcome to the show, Tom Reynolds.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you here. And yeah, that conversation we were just having before we came on the air is interesting. So this book is coming out in America today. It's been out in Europe before, and it hit number three in Ireland.
Yeah, which I thought was, you know, quite apropos, because if you've ever been to Ireland, you know, they love their gloom and they love their drink.
They do. They're proud of the gloom.
Oh, yeah.
That is a very...
Let's have another one now. Oh, Clancy. Let's just throw it down.
Let's start
a fight.
Exactly. I tell a story about being in Kilkenny in the middle of the night. I was at a comedy festival there, and there's three of us going back to the hotel, and in the middle of the street is this sort of bloated Irish guy with a pint glass. There's no bar in sight. It's half full, and he raises it, and he goes, it's good to be happy. And then he takes the glass down and looks into it and goes, there's no hope. Which I thought really summed up the history of Irish poetry.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, Yeats and James Joyce.
All
those gloomy guys.
Absolutely. So now this book, in terms of the 52 songs and the subcategories that you created, these are your opinions because, you know, obviously there's a never-ending array of depressing songs.
Yeah, you could do a time-life series of books on this whole thing, one for each month. I mean, there's like 52,000 depressing songs out there. So all you people who've been writing me nasty things on the internet because I'd left out a Smith song, excuse me. I'm sorry, okay? There's only so many you can fit in.
And you say that there are actual websites devoted to this topic?
Yeah, well, I've found blogs, I've found message boards, I have found discussion pages, I've found MySpace pages. It's unbelievable that people will spend days debating, going back and forth, whether Cat Power is more depressing than Tori Amos. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it's apparently it really strikes a chord with people, and they're very opinionated, and it becomes almost a contentious issue, you know.
Like, yeah.
There's Iran, and there's depressing music, and there's all these depressing things out there.
And people that just fester about it. I mean, I put it out to my blog today, and we've got some suggestions, and then we'll go over some of yours. We've got this from PJ. He says, A Man Needs a Maid by Neil Young is a depressing song. Now, I'm not sure how that goes. Can you hum a few bars, anybody?
I don't know it.
Do you know it?
I actually don't know that. And I know Neil Young's music pretty well because I had to listen to a lot of it for this book because, you know, like, this is the Tonight's Night album from 1974.
Tonight's
it's one
tonight.
Gloomy mother. It's just really... Because it's about the death of two of his bandmates,
right?
You know,
but the thing I noticed about Neil Young, no one really he survives the test of time.
Yeah.
There's something timeless about his music and some of it's just great. But he's a heavy cat.
Sure,
and you know, how about this one? We've got For No One by the Beatles. That's pretty depressing.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I didn't put any Beatles songs in there, but actually, to me, the most depressing Beatles song, which and I'm quite certain of this, is a very obscure one called Blue Jay Way. George Harrison, yeah, that's on. Yeah, just George Harrison. It's on Magical Mystery.
Is that the one?
It's about nothing. The song's about nothing.
Come on, Jim.
I was going to say, there's a fog upon LA, and my friends have lost their way.
It's about nothing. It's about him sitting in a house waiting for his manager to show up.
Right, it's kind of creepy.
I was going to say Harrison's other song on the White Album. It's been a long, long.
My Guitar Gently Weeps. Yeah.
No, long, long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really gloomy and outside.
Well, yeah, this is like a
Beatles
song.
Well, I'll tell you, he's another one, not unlike Neil Young. That the sort of bottom tone of a Harrison song is kind of longing and a little dark.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you talking about sad as in sad?
Those are a lot of categories.
Sad as in ugh.
No. You'll see. We'll go over the categories. Yeah. Now here's someone. Orbit Boy said Seasons in the Sun, which is in your book.
Oh, yeah. That's very ranked pretty high.
Cats in the Cradle, which could fall under one of my favorite categories. I don't want to tip it, though, because I think it's hilarious. American Pie. That's depressing because it's irritating after a certain point.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of those.
It's like 9 minutes long. I mean, it's a long song.
And then someone's talking about Waits. Now, Waits is kind of heavy, but I wouldn't call him depressing because he's too cool to be depressing. Georgia Lee by Tom Waits. I don't know about that one. How about...
he's got some pretty depressing songs.
Well, yeah, he does.
Voice.
Yeah. All you need is a spoon, a tin can, and one string bass to do almost any current Tom Waits song.
I know.
Song.
He does that minimalist stuff.
It's great.
What's in the belfry?
Lou Reed's Berlin album.
The entire album.
That whole album. That
world's only heroin opera.
You know,
it is.
Yeah.
The heroin opera.
So now what drove you to do this, man? I mean, you just saw an angle or you just thought it needed to be done?
No, in all honesty, I was actually approached to do this by a publisher in England. And in hindsight, I think they were hitting the Guinness a little heavy that day when they were saying the editorial.
Come on.
Look at my idea for a book. Let's get some bastards listen to a bunch of crap for a year and then write about it. Who are they?
Let's call Tom. Hello. Yeah.
Are you willing to do this?
Sure. Okay. I did. I agreed to do it. And but they seriously came up with this idea to have someone, examine as many songs as possible and come up with at least 50 that would at least once tempt you to want to kill yourself while listening to it. So
how'd they get your name? What have you done before?
Well, I had to work with one of the editors there before. I had written something completely different, a kind of a serious study about outlaw biker culture, and for some reason he thought of me 5 years later, and it's like, yeah, you could do this because you know a lot about music and you're kind of a depressing guy.
That's interesting. Do you know my buddy Jack Boulware? Do you know Boulware?
No.
He's a writer. He does travel writing, and he used to do The Nose up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He's kind of an out there guy. He's going to be on the show a little later. He writes about weird stuff. So look, why don't we do this? We'll take we can go to break now, can't we, and take a long segment on the other side and go over some of these songs. Our guest is Tom Reynolds. The book is I Hate Myself and Want to Die, the 50 Most Depressing Songs, and we'll come back and we'll go over about maybe 10 of them, 8, something like that. All right, Tom?
Sure.
Okay, stay with us.
Now back to America's most trusted source for stuff, Mark Maron.
Da 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 da. Isn't that it?
Please don't be long. Right?
Yeah, isn't that Blue Jay Way?
Yeah,
it is.
Please don't
you be very long. Please don't be long. It actually gets irritating after a while.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, please don't be long. Please don't be long.
I don't even think that's a sad
please.
Song, really. I think that's just kind of like a spooky drug song.
Well, that's what I mean. It's spooky. That's what I mean by depressing. Ennui plays a big part of it. We're just like, oh, come on, stop.
Yeah. All right, it won't be long. Let's get on with it. So you did how many interviews today? Were you like 90th interview?
So all my enthusiasm is drained. So this interview is going to suck. I did 18 interviews.
They throw you in a booth. You put the phone on.
No, I was on my phone at home.
You did it from home? They didn't even stick you in a radio booth?
No. They were going to have you go to a place in Sherman Oaks, and they said, we'll make it more convenient for you. We're going to call you. Okay, all the phone glued to my head for 3 hours, from one little earpiece.
And then your publicist just comes on going, you're on with Bill and the Booger Man in Tampa.
I had some very nice guy named Ross who was in New York who was like, Tommy, they're okay. We're going to throw you to Orlando. Just stand by.
So what happened? You did an oldie station in the...
Well, all the interviews I thought went really well, but there I got this one oldies guy who was approaching it like quantum physics, and he was like way too analytical, was pontificating. Like, well, I always thought, when Mickey Carr was doing it, I was like, why are you name-dropping Vicky Carr? What are you doing?
Yeah. All right, so let's go over some of these. Let's start with this one. I'm going to cover 6 of the... I guess I don't know how many categories you got in here.
I have 10 categories.
10 categories. So this one is, of course, under I Hate Myself and Want to Die.
The Friday night charades of youth
You know, it's weird. You know everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the criteria. For the most part, I stayed away from obscure songs because now, if I went for the obscure, there's zillions.
Sure. So what were your feelings about this song?
Well, this song came out in the early 70s as Janis Ian's at 17, which is her biggest hit.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was ironic because of all the songs I've heard that could be released as a single, this one that compelled teenage girls to shove their head into a trash compactor. It has to be this one, you know. Because she's talking about acne, being fat, and no one likes her, and not being picked, from choosing sides in basketball, no one picked me and stuff.
But don't you think it made some girls say, I'm like that, I feel better.
Yeah, I know. I know that's the point of it. But it's not just the lyrics to it, because actually the lyrics get kind of trippy after a while.
They
start talking, then it starts, debentures of quality, and I'm like, okay, if you just insulted me, I didn't get it.
All right, so now we move into I'm trying to be profound and touching, but really suck at it.
Don't cry out loud.
Ooh. Yeah.
Just keep
There's no way to make this okay.
Yeah, well, this is Melissa Manchester covering the song by Carol Bayer Sager and Peter Allen, which is Don't Cry Out Loud. Another number one hit, by the way. Big hit back in the 70s. And see, that's, to me, a typical example of the lyrical felonies of Carol Bayer Sager.
Yeah.
I mean, she's won a Grammy, she's won a Tony, she's won an Oscar, and she's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and I don't get it. I mean, I just think her stuff is... I mean, she did that AIDS song, What Friends Are For, and she was lionized for writing Keep Smiling, Keep Shining. Ooh, no one could have thought of that rhyme.
You know? And then there's this one that was plowed into my head when I was in seventh grade.
I see a memory I never realized. Ah, yes, Mandy. It's interesting about that song, and to this day, a lot of people think it's about Barry Manilow's dog.
Is it?
Yeah, there's an urban myth behind that song, that it's that Barry Manilow cast his dog away. And if you think about that, to me, that's the only song where, depending on how you interpret it, it's depending on how depressed you want to be. Because if you want to look at it as Barry Manilow breaking up with a girl, like that would ever happen, you get slightly depressed. But if it's about him abandoning his cute little dog, throwing, get out of here, throwing it in the alley, just shivering, in the cold, wondering why it's been thrown out, then that's so sad. It's so depressing.
I thought it was about a one-night stand with a crazy girl.
Yeah.
And they came to pick her up the next day, and he's sad because it was the best sex he ever had. Yeah. That was what I did with it. And that's the great thing about good songwriting is that, hey, you can go anywhere you want.
You can misinterpret it freely.
Exactly. This is the next category from I'll sing songs about drugs. People will take me seriously. That one.
And you stare at the Billy Joel's. Yeah, Captain Jack. Yeah, to his credit, even he doesn't like this song. No, he doesn't. He won't perform it.
You want to hear something sad, Tom?
Well, but it was one of his. It was his very first hit song before Piano Man.
I for the longest time thought it was about masturbation.
Yeah. Well, that's because that word occurs in the song.
It does?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you just said it on masturbate.
Masturbate.
Yeah, I thought that we were going the non-drug route with the getting high.
No. Captain Jack is about a drug dealer named Captain Jack.
All right. So this one, my dad, when I was growing up in the station wagon, we had the 8-track, and this was on one of his oldies collections. And it is honestly one of the most haunting songs. It's under I Was a Teenage Car Crash category. It's a great song.
Oh, yeah. This is that fateful night. Hang on, listen.
The car was stalled up on the railroad track. I pulled you out and we were safe. But you went wrong.
No, you stupid! Don't go! What are you doing?
And she gets hit by the train.
Yeah!
And now she goes back. See, that's the thing about the teenage car crash songs is that it's always about altruism and an appalling lack of any common sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because they all die from, like, I'm going to enter a stock car race to win some money.
Yeah. being blindly in love. All right, here's, before we run out of time, we got a couple more horrifying remakes of already depressing songs.
Yeah,
it's an anthem of depression.
Well, the thing is that, because actually with that song, Celine Dion kind of defied the laws of physics because she took one of the most depressing songs ever recorded and somehow made it more depressing. It's like, how do you do that? How do you take Eric Carmen's All By Myself and actually make it more depressing than the original? And she did.
That's their talent. Yeah. She's very skilled at that.
And also, it has one of the greatest, I call it in the book, brain concussion modulations, where they violently change keys at the very end, and they jump up like, you know, four or five keys in order to show how high their range is.
And
it sounds like a train crashing at the end of the song.
And to amplify the depression.
Yeah.
Take it up a notch.
Exactly.
So this is my favorite category of all. I'm telling a story nobody wants to hear. Let's hear it.
At 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave
in. Who cares? This was a huge song.
It was. It's about 29 guys dying in a shipwreck. And that's what the song's about. The wreck of the Evan Fitzgerald, which is a real true sea tragedy up in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a sad story, but I just love the title of the category. And I remember I went to see Gordon Lightfoot around this time, because this was sort of a resurrection of his career.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. He was kind of, it came in the mid-70s. He'd done Sundown, which is the number one hit.
Sundown, that was it.
You know, and then this song came out right after it. So he had two of them back-to-back, and he disappeared. But then there
was a big gap between If You Could Read My Girl. And then where was he until Sundown?
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah, that song is, it's actually, if you read newspaper accounts of it and read the lyrics, they're very similar.
So here we go. So we've got those categories and a couple other ones. She Hates Me, I Hate Her. Horrifying, we already did that. Okay. I Mope, Therefore I Am. I had no idea that song was so morbid. And Perfect Storms. Get the book. It is I Hate Myself, I Want to Die, the 52 most depressing songs you've ever heard. Tom Reynolds, thank you. For sharing this with the world.
Yes,
for bringing it all to our attention.
I know. I favorite for mankind. For
yes.
Everyone. And bookstores everywhere.
Very witty, biting essays on each song by Mr. Tom Reynolds. You can link to it on our website, markmaron.com. Thanks again for coming in.
Thanks, Mark.
Back to a man who sailed around the world in his three-masted schooner, the Smark.
Thanks, man.
Mark Maron.
That's me. Hey, you guys, tomorrow, Ed Asner, Mr. Grant, in-house. You're going to get him going on the 9/11 thing. He's one of those 9/11 conspiracy, not conspiracy, independent speculative investigator looking into things. I think it's going to be a little harder than them, considering that the Pentagon released a video today of American Flights 77 crashing into the Pentagon. They released Pentagon outdoor video footage at the behest of Freedom of Information Act request by Judicial Watch. So that is out. So now they're going to have to start discrediting the Pentagon footage, which should happen. Because this is really, it's really sort of leading up to becoming the biggest conspiracy since JFK. This will go unresolved, and speculators, independent investigative speculators, will be perusing the information for years to come. And I've heard that Ed Asner is on board with the conspiracy thing, and we're going to talk about that, because there may be a conspiracy of some kind. I don't know how deep it is. I'm not going to...
Where'd that other missile come from, the grassy knoll or something?
No, there was a second guy with a silo on his shoulder. Yeah, there was a second and a third guy that had a launcher. Yeah, the grassy knoll was up near the border of Canada. It was a silo. All right. Anyways, don't mock those people. They're the last people you want to mock. All right?
Canadians? Because,
not Canadians, just the people that are doing the big work on their own dime. Here we go. Every week we reflect in our times of sorrow, my friends, as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance. Yeah.
How you doing?
Good. One of those days, is it?
Never ending. Never ending death. Pascal Camar, toy maker who created the popular JFK and E.T. dolls. Pascal Camar, who in early 1963 became a millionaire with the debut of his 11-inch President Kennedy doll, has died after 30 disappointing years of trying to unload a warehouse full of Martha Moxley hand puppets.
I don't even know who that is.
Martha Moxley. Look it up. It's worth the laugh.
Is it next to Hobo Kelly?
Martha Moxley.
Okay.
Look it up. Remember the whole masturbating in a tree thing?
Yeah.
Martha Moxley?
No.
At first,
I bet Jack Boulware knows it.
Okay, we'll ask him.
Yeah, first Kamar couldn't make enough JFK dolls to keep up with demand, but when that fateful day arrived on November 22nd, 1963, sales went down faster than Marilyn Monroe on Peter Lawford's yacht.
I know about that.
Mm-mm. In 1982, he signed a licensing agreement to produce the E.T. doll, a move that not only saved his business, but also enabled countless American children to realize their dream of cuddling up against something that looks like a mummified fetus.
Yeah.
You're cute.
Yeah.
That movie sucked, by the way. I never liked it. Yeah. Never. Always the marketing genius, Kamar was able to meet the demands of delivering millions of the wrinkled potbelly creatures on time by making only slight modifications to his surplus of LBJ dolls. Kamar requested his body be hollowed out, stuffed with beans, cotton, and straw, and sold to a guy who gets off dressing like a hedgehog.
Wow, that's quite a...
A lot of references in that whole bit, right?
Yeah.
George Lenchner, prominent mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
George Lenchner, the nationally known math educator whose work gave rise to interscholastic math leagues throughout the country, has died of severe wedgie complications.
Even at that age, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's relentless. It really is. Lenchner was executive director of Math Olympiads for Elementary and Middle Schools, a nonprofit organization he founded to help kids deal with the trauma of getting shoved into their lockers. A gifted pianist in his youth, Lenchner once toured in the Borscht Belt with Mo Howard.
Really?
It's true. Who taught him the maximum number of times an audience could laugh at Mo Larry the Cheese before asking for a refund.
Yeah.
Mr. Lenchner is survived by his two sons, one running at 10 miles per hour from a bully in Chicago, and the other running at 7 miles per hour from a bully in New York. If each bully is traveling 2 miles an hour faster than each of his sons, then how long before someone gets their glasses broken? The deceased asked that he be buried in his pocket protector. Woo! This has been this week's Weekly Remembrance. Until next week, this is Morton Mortensen saying... He's chopping onions.
Oh, man. That was a good one. That was a good one. Our next guest has been a close friend of mine for years. He was the publisher of the now-defunct seminal freak show Out There magazine, The Nose. He spent time with Satan. He's hung out with the inventor of the window pane delivery system for LSD. He's chased wild pigs through the hills of Northern California and pursued and caught the elusive wahoo fish off the coast of New Orleans. Jack Boulware has traveled the far reaches of the world, chasing down the most marginal travel stories available. His work has appeared in Playboy, New York Times Magazine, Wired, Maxim, and Salon.com. He's here now. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Hey there.
Hey, buddy. Do you know who Martha Moxley is?
Yeah, she was the girl in Connecticut who got killed by the cousin of the Kennedy.
Oh, the Kennedy killer guy.
Yeah, yeah.
With the golf club or something.
Yeah,
right.
Everybody knows that whole story.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize that. I thought
everybody knows about Martha Moxley.
And he was masturbating in a tree.
Yes.
He was masturbating in a tree.
So, okay, look, I get this call from me the other day, a message. Marin, call me back. It's an emergency. I'm in trouble, Marin. So here I thought, like, something happened with your woman, family problem. But no, I get on the phone with you, and what happened?
I bought a new guitar.
You were in a fit of panic over the fact that you were going to buy a new SG at the guitar store.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a guy in his 40s, you know, going into a store to buy a brand new electric guitar. How screwed up is that?
I know the feeling. It's sad, but you went ahead and did it.
I went ahead and did it because I was an idiot. I put down money on a layaway because the guy says, well, might not be here tomorrow.
Right, of course.
They say that.
Of course. So you're in the store, and you're there, and did you pull it off the rack and plug her in and compete with the other idiots in the store?
Oh, yeah, of course. You do the whole ritual, you know. Like, you go into, this was Guitar Center, so it's like a Mardi Gras museum. There's guitars everywhere hanging from the ceilings, you know. There's videos playing, like, just tiny, you know, 10, 15-second snippets of your favorite rock stars.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. You hear, like, guys noodling. There was one guy playing House of the Rising Sun out of tune on a guitar, really loud. And the sales guy showing me around going, God, I hate when people do that. He was so tired of it. I said, what's the most expensive guitar you have here? Just because I have to wait for a few minutes.
Yeah.
And, he goes, well, we have a $19,000 Paul Reed Smith. I'm like, show me that.
Yeah.
So we go over to a case, and there's this guitar, you know, encrusted with a dinosaur pattern over the main body of the guitar, all inlaid with abalone.
Wow.
I mean, why? My friend Michael is with me going, where's the abalone from? I love that question.
Yeah.
Like, is it harvested? Is it natural? You know, because that really matters.
But who the hell would buy a guitar like that? I've always been attracted to those beat-up 57 broadcasters or the Tellys that go back to the late 50s. Like, I like the classic one. I never was in for the inlay or any of that crap. It's just going to get messed up anyways.
Yeah, well, you know, people who buy that don't even know how to play guitar. They'd put it on a wall and talk about it, you know.
Well, and also, like, I've got, like, 3 or 4 guitars, and I had an SG that I would have sold you, and the bill of goods the guy gave me on that SG, man, I walked into a, it was Manny's, or not Manny's, Sam Ash in New York. And I know this guy. I'd seen this deal, this salesman there, because I go in there and look at guitars like a 12-year-old. And it's a used SG, and it's got little glittery stickers on each of the knobs, and it's worn down on the top of the guitar. So I'm like, what's the story with this guitar? And I think I paid like $400 for it. It's like a 72 SG. And the guy goes, oh, that was played upside down by a guy in a church band. Never got played anywhere else.
That's what he told you.
Right. So it was played by a left-handed dude in a gospel band in a church. So I'm thinking, man, I'm like Robert Johnson.
Oh,
this
yeah.
guy's
got
the
whole bunch of soul in the wood.
Yeah, it's all it's in there, man. So I never play it, and I would have given it to you. But you got a brand spanking new SG.
I'm an idiot.
No, you're not. I mean, it's worth it. It's going to be fun.
Well, you know, you go on eBay, and there's all these guys selling this stuff, and they all put little ads in like, you know, I've got 18 guitars, and my wife says I have to start thinning the herd, so I'm putting this one up for sale. There's, like these, there's always a picture of the guitar in, you know, in a carpeted bedroom leaning up against a wall. You see electrical outlet, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, here's my pride and joy. I'm willing to give it up. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. I'm starting to auction off my dream.
Oh, exactly. Or liquidate, you know, part of my hope. Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But the thing that people need to understand is that you are in a semi-functional, semi-annual band called Resin.
I'd say annual at best, yeah.
And what is the manifest? What is the mission statement of Resin?
We put it together for one night for a magazine issue release party about the resurgence of marijuana and popular culture.
Yeah.
And the magazine went out of business a long time ago, but we seem to find ourselves still doing this. So we have songs that are all about, they're all about pot that we've written, or they're all like stoner songs from the 70s.
So is this available? I mean, I know people are going to be listening and be like, oh, I got to get a Resin CD.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're so exclusive that there aren't any.
but they are available for weird events.
we can play. We put on wigs, you know, occasionally. We, you know, did the whole thing.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. What the hell was that other guitar you used to have? That, yeah, that was ready to go, dude. You deserve a new electric. What was that thing, an Ibanez or something?
I had an Ibanez Flying V. It was like a cast-off from some big hair band from the 80s on Sunset Strip,
You can't even hang out with that guitar. I used to come over to your house and be like, let's jam. And you can't even sit down with the thing without sliding down your pants. You got to hold it like Segovia.
Yeah, it's for rock only, you know.
Oh, whoops. Okay, so now Resin got together last weekend for an event.
Yeah, these guys that we know, this kind of underground art, you know, denizens, long time in San Francisco, decided to do a tribute to Frank Zappa and the Mothers on Mother's Day.
Oh, no.
And somehow we were included in this whole thing.
Well, yeah, that's the weirdest thing, because you guys are kind of a garagey, kind of like a hard rock outfit.
Yeah, you know, that's a nice way of saying we're not very good, but thank
right.
you, Mark.
Yeah, but I mean, I would imagine that Zappa heads are just sort of like completely anal musical wizards that are, you know, completely into orchestration and hitting everything just right, because, you know, despite what anyone ever thinks about Zappa, I mean, the guy could put together some music.
Well, we thought, great, this would be kind of cool, because I'm a big fan of the Zappa touring bands of the 70s and the 80s, when they were really, it was all about pristine production quality,
yeah.
The sound was impeccable, you know, it was all about indulgent solos, and I loved that part of it. But we get there, and we realize, no, it's not about that Zappa at all, it's only about the Zappa and the Mothers of the 60s. So it's like you say, very intense orchestrations, these Baroque vocalists, you know, going on. It's kind of like a demented Herman's Hermits. That's
so
what
that was
it sounded
like. Who was that? That was a Captain Beefheart era?
And the Freak Out, We're Only in It for the Money. I mean, stuff that, you know, I was 5 years old when it came out. I have no idea what it is. I don't understand it at all. And all these other people are singing along. People have come and wearing Hawaiian shirts and tie-dye, and they have funny glasses and funny shoes. And, you know, they really came to worship all of this stuff.
So what was that? Hot Rats, Weasels Rip My Flesh, Hollywood, what was that one? Hollywood something? Oh, man. So there's some pretty goofy music. So,
yeah, no, it's very intense. But if you didn't grow up smoking pot, listening to it, it sounds like Herman's Hermits, I'm telling you.
All right, and how many bands played?
There were probably 25 acts.
25 acts? Was it a music festival? How the hell long did that go on for?
That was a lot of Zappa.
Oh, my God.
It went on for about 4 hours.
Yeah, and you guys went, you were the headliner? You closed it out?
We cleared the room.
Why? How the hell did that happen?
We cleared the room. Well, we thought, we're not professional musicians, we can't hope to learn Zappa note for note. And besides, why? You know, there's enough people that are already doing that. So we decided to play Smoke on the Water, which is about a Frank Zappa incident, whereas this, you know, place burned to the ground and, you know, they had to evacuate during in the middle of a Zappa concert and all their equipment got destroyed. So we played Smoke on the Water, and then we thought, what would be a song that would really piss off all the Zappa heads? So we picked probably one of the most filthy Zappa songs he ever recorded, called The Illinois Enema Bandit.
Yeah.
About a real burglar in near Chicago who would burglarize homes and then tie up co-eds and give them an enema.
Wow.
So Zappa thought that would be interesting to write a song about.
And it cleared the room of Zappa fans.
We thought they were going to sing along. We had an enema dance contest all prepared. We had an enema bag filled with chocolate milk. I was all set to MC the dance contest.
Did you really?
And, you know, people were looking at us like, okay, great. Anyway, I'm going to go outside now.
Yeah, we're going to go outside and talk about lofty things.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, the third solo on the second song of the second side of the Zappa's third album. You know?
So when you come down, here's the deal. We're gonna finish this up, and when you come down to L.A., you're bringing the new SG. We're going to go in the garage. We're going to lay some tracks down. The hell with that. Next time you come down, you bring the guitar in. Jim plays guitar. Sleepy Bill Kolar plays guitar. He's sometimes Magic Bill Kolar. It goes back and forth. He plays guitar. Andy, you play some guitar? Oh, dude. That's the perfect old guy band.
That's like five too many guitars.
Yeah, no drummer, no bass player, just a bunch of guys noodling on guitar. So we'll
great.
Do that.
It'll be like Molly Hatchet.
All right, Jack, thanks. I'll talk to you later.
All right, man.
See you later.
Bye.
Okay, so coming up in a second, we'll do the short order news, and maybe we'll address in a small way this diesel steam engine thing. But we're not going to have time. Stay with us.
Hear that baby crying? Is the house on fire? Who cares? Because right after this break, Mark's going to read his short order news. So sit down and shut up.
And now he's got the scars to prove it. Mark Maron.
Tinseltown Rebellion was the one I was thinking of. I'm not a huge Zappa fan, but I can listen to Joe's Garage. I love Joe's Garage. I'll listen to it. And I love it because how sometimes the orchestration, the production's so clean, dude. Look, we'll get into this.
Yeah, there's never a big... I never got into them.
Yeah, but you can't deny his peculiar genius.
No.
I once asked my friend Jonathan, who's in the record business, he's like, does Zappa make money? He's like, look, if people know his name... Zappa, you know, even you know, it's like one of those universal names everyone knows. He's got to be, you know, he made like 900 records. All right. Look, I knew Moon for a while, and she's a wonderful woman. We should have her on the show. I'm sure she's doing something. Okay, Jim, we'll talk about the steam and the diesel tomorrow. Can you hold it
till
tomorrow?
Okay, man, but, you know, we got to correct Moon. What's her name?
Motown Girl.
Motown Girl.
On the blog. Yeah.
Why
don't you just let the steam build and we'll unleash the Earl valve tomorrow. We'll loosen the valve. Here's a second edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News, so you'll be informed on the news today. There you go. At a recent appearance, Karl Rove said most Americans liked President Bush and blamed his poor poll ratings on the Iraq War. Rove said that Bush's likability ratings are far higher than his approval ratings, and they're going to stay that way until the terrorists finally succumb to smirking and hollow gestures of homespun ignorance. Do I screw up one word on every joke? Homespun ignorance. The Bush administration announced the United States will restore full diplomatic relations with Libya 25 years after they were cut. The Libyans say they can't wait to catch up on American culture and are looking forward to a summer tour by that big American star, Thomas Dolby. Researchers at the University of Nevada, Reno, have concluded there is a direct correlation between secondhand smoke in Las Vegas casinos and damage to employees' DNA. The researchers also concluded that there's a direct correlation between having that fifth shot of Jack and sweeping with a divorced Keno waitress.
True.
The researchers say that this is the tragic explanation to why Siegfried and Roy can't have kids. Also, come on! Come on!
They can't.
Well, he's not well, the one, right? That's the short order news for tonight. Isn't he still bad?
He's mauled by a homophobic tiger.
The tiger just grabbed him by the head and started dragging him around.
Evidently. Really, tiger does not like magic.
Dude, a bear ate a monkey in a zoo in the Netherlands somewhere yesterday. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that horrible picture of that sloth bear eating a...
A sloth bear, you know, throwing that monkey around.
Yeah.
It's really horrible and sad, but it is it's the way it is. You know, my dad would say, yeah, that's what happens. That monkey probably just figured it all out, too. The poor monkey probably just realized, hey, I know what life means. And bam.
Your dad would say that.
But my dad would say, that bear's just going to die, even though he's satisfied with the monkey he just ate. Yeah, my dad's Mr. Happy. But he'll even say this when he's happy. He'll be like, how you doing? I'm like, fine, how you doing? I feel great. And I don't say things like, well, that's going to change in a couple of days, and you'll be dead soon. I don't say that to him.
But you're thinking of it.
Huh?
You're thinking it.
No, I'm trying to love my parents.
Then you get that big inheritance.
They squandered it. Dude, it's squandered. There was never a big one, and there's nothing left, my friend.
On candy?
I don't know on what. It's hard to know. So we got a big show tomorrow. We got Ed Asner, very excited about that. Michelle Goldberg, who is the author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, or the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade, one of my favorite subjects. Eric Bates will also be with us, the National Affairs Editor of Rolling Stone Magazine. Again, happy birthday to those of you who are celebrating. And, you know, good night, sheeple. Hell difference does it make?